Dublab. Welcome to the Quarantine Tapes, a daily podcast from Onassis, LA and Dublab. Hosted by Paul Holdengraber, this series chronicles shifting paradigms in the era of social distancing.
Greetings, this is Paul Holdengraber, your host for the Quarantine Tapes, brought to you by Onassis LA and Dublab. I am thrilled to announce that we have asked various former Quarantine Tape guests to host, during a week, guests of their choice in total freedom. They have absolute carte blanche. This week, I have asked the very great Imani Perry, professor of African studies at Princeton University, to serve as our host. Imani Perry is an intellectual, a writer, born in Birmingham, Alabama, at the dawn of the freedom movement. She lives the life of the mind through literature, criticism, music, and art. Perry's hallmarks are passionate curiosity, rigorous contemplation, and dedication to the collective we. Her children, Freeman and Issa Rabb, she tells me, keep her honest and dreaming. I hope you enjoy this week of the Quarantine Tapes, hosted by Imani Perry.
Hi, Esther. Dr.
Hi. Imani.
It's so wonderful to talk to you. Before we start, I just wanted to thank you for being one of our physician leaders in what has been a really difficult season. And you have spoken to this moment, which has been so terrifying, with brilliance and the depth of knowledge and generosity and clarity that I know means a great deal to lots of people, including me. So thank you for that.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It doesn't feel like any of those things on this end. It just feels like trying to make it through a day at a time with a lot of uncertainty, but I appreciate it.
Thank you. So we graduated from Yale College in 1994, and you were an English major, correct?
Oops. That's right.
And I guess that made me wonder, you know, you're a lover of literature, if there had been anything, there's been anything that you've read or reflected on during, whether it's poetry or a novel, or that has been meaningful for you as we've sort of made our way through 2020 and 2021.
There's been so much. This has actually been a big reading year for me, just because, I mean, as busy as work is, we've all also needed respite. And it's also been a lot of home time, you know? So I think time when normally things would be a little bit more frantic professionally, I constantly had a pile of books by my bedside. And a lot of them really helped me have humility and grapple with the role that healthcare has played in doubling down on inequities. You know, so books like Caste, Medical Apartheid, So You Want to Talk About Race, there are books that America was reading, really, but especially, I mean, there were pieces of health and health equity, you know, the writings of Martin Luther King. Basically, if you looked at anyone who wrote about racism, about inequity, health was there and healthcare was there. And just like any other public policy, the policies that we created, the institutions we built and were very happy participants of, you know, all had components of structural racism that really had, you know, it just had this manifestation in this pandemic that I think was the most disturbing thing for me as this thing played out. There was always something. And I'm not, you know, I'm an ER doc, so I don't have a long attention span. So I tend to read things. I usually have 3 or 4 books and I just pull one out and I'll read like a chapter or two, you know, and then I'll switch it up and I'll read a different book. And that's how I get through books over time. And so there's been a lot of different things in my rotation, but certainly reading, reflecting has been a part of this. And it's also just a nice break from the science. I mean, there's only so many preprint scientific publications you can read before you're like, oh, can I have something that feels like a cohesive, you know, piece of writing?
It's interesting because I was going to ask you about being an ER doc, and I was imagining that it's you know, it's a place where you probably see this, the entire spectrum of, you know, of certainly of the place that you, you know, you live in Oregon, but also of inequality, right? Because there are a whole host of people who come to the, that's their primary care, unfortunately, because there's not a lot of access. So you see, imagine you see the world, really.
That was really the surprising thing about becoming an ER doctor. I mean, I think, was it in college where we started having ER watch parties? I mean, the show ER was so popular. That was college, right? I remember being in like the old J.E. Buttery that was so gross, you know? It was like probably not code, you know what I mean? Yeah. But hanging out there on Thursday nights and we would all kind of cram in there and watch this TV. And that was really I didn't have doctors in my family. And so that was my image of what the ER was, you know, it was like traumas, heart attacks, rushing from scene to scene, you know, there was just kind of this, this pace to it, the high acuity, all these things I imagined. And there were human interest stories woven in there, but I thought that was part of the drama of the TV show. And then as I started to practice, I realized the heart attacks, the traumas, those things are actually the simple part of your job. I mean, you know, it's like somebody's coming in, they're having a heart attack and they're about to die. It's like what I do isn't a high cognitive load. It needs to happen really fast. And we're working together as a team, but it's not like I'm like, what creatively can I do here? Or, you know, what, you know, there's just a standard of care and we implement it. Do you know what I mean? And so once you've been practicing for more than say 5 or 7 years, that's not the hard part of the job. The hard part of the job is all those pieces that no one has an answer for because we've built these systems and structures that are so wrong. And any person who retains their humanity from the time before they became doctors and retains their like kind of clear perspective can see that there are things that we do every day in practice that our systems lead us to do, that our individual choices lead us to do, that are simply wrong and not what a kind or decent person would do, you know? And so, I mean, you have people coming in the dead of winter and you're like, why are you here? And they're like, I have chest pain. I mean, it's clear they're there because it's negative 15 degrees outside and they don't have a house and the shelter fills up at 7 p.m. And if you actually are semi-employed, you cannot get there in time. Sometimes they're with their families and they have diarrhea running down their leg because they had no access to a bathroom and they're on insulin, but insulin needs to be refrigerated and there's no place they could find to refrigerate their insulin. And you're basically going to clean them up, give them paper scrubs and send them out. And you're like, my mother would be ashamed of me if she saw me right now. And yet this is what we do. And why do we have a system that actually sets up this person to fail again and again and again? And we just do the Band-Aid, quick shower, paper scrubs, and send them out again to fail again. And it feels wrong every day. And then you just have these moments where you're like charging out of there. And you're like, I have to do something about this. I mean, I think so many of us feel this way. And to not find an outlet for that emotion, I think is the recipe for burnout and is why so many people are disillusioned with medicine. I mean, lots of other things, but I think that is a big chunk of it for people.
Mm. So, well, what I'm curious as to at what point did you know that you wanted to be a doctor and then the decision to commit to ER?
Yeah. So I think at some point it was really late. So I was English major and not pre-med at Yale. And so senior year kind of got to that point where we're like, what are we doing after graduation? I don't know if you knew. I didn't really know. I didn't have a plan. And so I ended up taking a couple years and doing my pre-meds in 2 years after college. Mm-hmm. And so kind of decided a little bit senior year that I was going to head in that direction and then kind of committed a year later after I'd gotten through pre-meds and taken my MCATs and gotten a research position and some things to do in that gap space. And then ER, my very first, so, you know, like I could not leave New Haven. It was like this rubber band that kept on pulling me back. So I was like, of all places. So I worked for Yale summer programs for a whole bunch of summers after we graduated, wow. And which was so fun. It was like, you were still there, but you were not really there, but it was really fun. You know, all these kids come in, they're meeting Yale for the first time. I was a program director, I think. And then something else, I can't remember, but I did it for like 4 or 5 years. So in those summers, I started doing some research up at Yale New Haven Hospital. And one of those research projects was in the ER. I was recruiting patients to an asthma study. So I would just sit there. I mean, I would sit there all night recruiting patients. And because it was slow sometimes, the docs would spend time with me. And I thought they were just wonderful people. And then I started doing procedures. You know, they'd be like, do you want to help out sewing this hand or, you know, help out with this trauma or just come in with us to the room? And I saw just the really amazing spectrum of disease of it's really about, it's not just what they present with, it's the whole backstory, you know? It's like, what is the context of your life that leads you to this moment where you came to the ER? And eliciting that story actually puts you in the best position to take good care of them. And so there is this narrative component to the job, you know, that's fascinating. Yeah, it's always interesting.
I mean, it's funny because I was wondering, and you sort of answered this implicitly, whether it was, whether you became invested in social justice and equity issues as you became a physician, as you went in the path of sort of practicing medicine, or whether that sort of led you to the path. And it sounds like the latter is true, that right, that you got invested as you were doing the work in New Haven, which is, of course, a city in which people are suffering a great deal.
Yeah, and really were then. I think it was a little bit of both. I mean, I think I probably was very receptive substrate, you know, to doing some advocacy work. But I also think as you do these experiences, they put their stamp on you. Like I spent, before I did med school and went that path, I spent, so the summer between our junior and senior years, I spent at a newspaper in Cleveland, the Cleveland Plain Dealer. And I was an editorial intern. So they kind of rotate you through all these, you know, different beats. And I had to cover one day some sort of tragedy. I think there was a house fire and somebody was gravely injured, and I was on that beat, so I went and helped cover that story. And I was like, I don't really want to be on this side of it. Do you know what I mean? Like something horrible had happened, and you're basically like, document and do not assist. You know what I mean? Right. And I was okay, I kind of, that was a very helpful experience for me, because I was like, I love the writing and I love the narrative, but the document and do not assist piece, that felt off for me, you know? And I think journalism has changed. I look at journalists as more change agents in this moment, very deliberately. So, you know, it's like during this pandemic, I've really thought of it as a partnership between public health and journalism. But I think then the mentorship was much more, you stay as objective and out of it as you can, you know, just document and do not intervene in any way. And I mean, you had people who were maybe still, you know, Pulitzer Prize winners who had like major mental health breakdowns afterwards, because people were like, how did you document that and not intervene? But that was their job. I mean, that's drilled into you, you know, when you're kind of on your apprenticeship and training mode. Anyway, so I was like, that is not for me, because I would like to roll up my sleeves and do something. And so, I mean, that's basically the you know, the mental hook that led me to medicine and doing stuff, something.
You mentioned earlier that, I mean, I think that's also such a powerful point, and it resonates with something you said earlier about how all of us, even those of us who are relatively secure, are in, this is an incredibly trying time. And I noticed that one of your recent articles is about parenting in the context of COVID. And I'd be interested to know a bit about how you manage a demanding life, engaged with the public and your own emotional economy, and also tending to children, which is this kind of, which I have personally found, you know, it's challenging. I mean, it's.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you saw part of my life just now. I mean, so what people listening don't know is like one of my children, I have a sign up outside that says, do not come in, you know, with us like a skull and crossbones. And my child was just like, I'll come in.
Yes.
Came in with her stuffed animal. She put my hat on a stuffed animal. I mean, there's just all this chaos all the time. But I think one of the first things is there's so many things that fill my cup, you know, right now. And I think part of it is, as challenging as it was to be a healthcare professional, there's always this element too of, I feel very lucky to be able to be in this work, because I also have so many friends who are like, I am frustrated about the way the pandemic is going. I wish I could do something to help, you know? And I know a lot of people felt this almost, is it guilt? I don't know. It's like this certainly restlessness, this dissatisfaction or this frustration with not being able to help when they are, you know, people who have energy and love and generosity and just, are, you know, cannot help. And being in a position where there's always something I can do. I mean, too many things that I can do. You know, it's like every night it's like, I could do a little more before I go to sleep. You know, I think that was like a really rough part of the first 4 months of the pandemic where none of us could sleep any of the time because there was always something we could do that perhaps translated into lives, you know? And so there was this like, it felt like too much many times still. However, we can contribute. And I think there is something in that that is really regenerating in parallel with all the, you know, the burnout and the moral injury that people are feeling. So, and then the other thing about a lot of healthcare workers, I mean, we had pay cuts, you know, we certainly have had some furloughs and layoffs, but for the most part, we've remained employed, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's like, how do you, there's just a piece of this when so many people have lost so much in this pandemic that I feel very blessed. And so, yeah, I mean, my kids are home. I have a home, you know, it's like, yes, I have exposure. You know, I have increased exposures at work, but my kids have remained safe. My, you know, my household has remained safe. My bubble has remained safe. I have a bubble. You know, it's like, I have so many patients who, when I'm like, okay, you've been exposed to coronavirus, you now must go on isolation, you know, or quarantine or isolation, depending on if they got diagnosed or not, or just exposed, for 10 to 14 days. And they're just like, that's not a thing. I live in a multifamily household. You know, we all share rooms. Somebody has to work. Otherwise, I don't feed my children. I'm fairly certain they would die first of that than coronavirus. You know, it's just like not a thing. And so I think that's where, again, working in the ER in particular is like this constant reminder of what I go home to. And just like the enormous, I mean, privilege is so overused, but I feel like it's a privilege to have this job. I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful that like somebody let me into med school, you know, 25 years ago. And that led me to get to help. I mean, it's like you wanted to get in so badly so that you could be a helper. Then you can't be like, oh, I'm a helper. This sucks. You know, I mean, you can, it's been an extraordinarily hard time, but there's just a little piece of me inside that is always just fundamentally grateful that I got into med school and then got into residency and then got hired by a bunch of people. And so then I'm in a position to help.
You know, I love, but I really do like the way that you use the word privilege, because so often it's used as this sort of as a proxy for not being involved, as opposed to as an opportunity, right? Do meaningful work, which really is a privilege, right? Because you have, and to do like deeply meaningful work, you have to have access to the tools to do so.
Yeah, I think that's it. I kind of, you know, some of these words become so overused that they, you know, you then use them and you kind of cringe because you're like, I know that sounds like I'm just dropping in a buzzword. Excuse me, you know, to kind of excuse a whole host of ways in which I'm skating by, and I'm trying not to use it like that.
For me, I mean, it really resonates with me because to be able to, you know, feel as though the work that you do can speak to the moment is just powerful. One of the things, and this is actually connects to one of the ways in which we sort of reconnected on social media, was you were giving me advice about trolls, right? And about the, you know, there's this white supremacist, white nationalist, misogynistic world on social media. And we enter into it to try to share things that we know and like sort of and advocate. That you're remarkable for sort of just kind of, so I was just asking about the sort of public realm of, and the way we're forced to interface with the ugliest segments of our society if we enter into the public arena. And I just wanted to know if you could talk a little about that as a woman of color, as a professional, and all those.
Yeah, totally. This is something that I was lucky that I got to go a few rounds with it before coronavirus, because I think it would have been a lot on top of also trying to figure out the pandemic and my place in it and the messaging and collaborations and things like that. But, you know, I had a couple of pretty remarkable moments on social media. You know, one was where I had posted a thread talking about racism from patients in the emergency department. That was like, must have been like 2017, maybe 2016. You know, it was a while ago. And I mean, there was a really wonderful positive response, but embedded in there, actually, there were a lot of people who messaged, you know, posted on the thread, actually even emailed me, wrote to my office about how I was inventing my experience of racism, you know? And so that was the first time it felt really intrusive into my life. And I had to figure out, oh my gosh, like, I mean, I went from being like, do I need to lock down my account? And, you know, and then last summer? Oh my gosh, I think it was not last summer, but the summer before, I put out this fairly benign tweet, I thought. It just said why people can be exhausting. I mean, yeah. And, you know, to me, I thought, I was so surprised that became a big deal because, first of all, I said can be, you know, and I thought exhausting was an extremely benign word. And I also thought it was factual, you know. you cannot say the word white person. At that time, you cannot say the word white person. There's something inherently hostile about using, people don't want to be identified as being, it's very interesting. It's remarkable. It's remarkable how you can both be like, that does not describe me. And yet I'm really owning this comment as being personal to me. And so that was probably when, you know, that was when I discovered there are a couple topics that really make people want to get out and do something to you. You know, racism is certainly one of them. Actually, vaccines are one of them. Animal experimentation is another, and then gun safety. Those are the ones that, this is a whole education I got from my hospital cybersecurity expert. He was like, those are the issues that make people want to come out, actually show up to harm you, or at least to threaten you. And so, you know, that was a really wild time because the threats to my hospital got so intense, and they were so specific in terms of harm to me that the operator, there's like a, you know, a team of people who answer the information line at the hospital. They took turns checking in with me to make sure I was okay. Those people who I've never interacted, they're like, you know, wonderful human beings. And they were like, is this doctor okay? And they would call me and check up on me, which is amazing. And then I got pulled from my shifts and we had to have like a police duty around my house. And so that was like a really interesting education. I mean, I had to do a lot of things to try to remove my children's names from the internet and things like that. And I, you know, changed the security behind all my accounts, but I was like, I had to learn really fast. And so I had things in place in the pandemic. And then I started to notice how often these exact things were happening. And it was almost always women of color. I mean, people just, there is, you know, nothing people hate more than women of color speaking out in a bold and truthful way without in some way kind of conceding, you know, a point to the dominant, you know, population. And so I kind of put together this little like package, and part of it was like not being on lists on Twitter. You know, when I posted this thing about how to get yourself off lists, it just had this like ridiculous response. And I think of it was a lot of us are kind of floating around having these experiences and kind of not sharing how to be safe. And I think now, you know, so I'm involved with this. I'm doing a whole bunch of stuff around vaccine delivery, particularly to communities of color who have been hit the hardest. It's basically what I'm, you know, doing night and day right now. And we are doing little initiatives like having, you know, maybe some conversations with well-recognized local or national celebrities and healthcare workers. And as we bring in these healthcare workers, we realized we have to actually do an onboarding process where we lock down all their accounts because we're going to be talking very frankly about racism. So we need to make sure that they go through a preparation process, take an online harassment course, secure all their accounts, you know, check and see what is in the public domain and try to remove it. And in some case, if they're on a website, make sure that their contact information isn't readily accessible. And as I go through this, it's like, it's such a shame that we have to do this. But on the other hand, you know, we have all this knowledge and experience from having been there. And it is so worth it. You know, and again, you know, it comes back to if that is the price we pay for getting to also be part of the conversation in a visible, positive, reliable way, totally fine. Pay my toll. You know what I mean? It's like, here's my credit card. Pay the toll because that is fine. It's ineffective largely. And I just have a thicker skin now. But it's like this thing. You just have to kind of A, get over the emotional mental toll of it. B, secure your family and make sure they feel they're comfortable with that non-zero risk that you have added to your life. And then C, put in all the protections you can, which is a little bit of a drain on your time, but becomes a little bit routine over time. So that's kind of how I think of it in general. But I am really concerned. And I mean, I think we need to do a lot more to protect people who are out there. And I wish it didn't have to be on their own time. You know, so if someone gave me like $1 billion right now to start something, I feel like I would probably put in place an institute where we have a tactical team that just goes, you know, like I see a woman of color. She's starting to speak up and really find her voice. We're just going to go in there, give her a suite of protections, protect her wherever we can in her thread, you know, and just like wrap it up so that she can move forward and really put her energy towards her thing and not towards this distraction.
That's, I mean, that sounds amazing. And I was just, you know, it's interesting that you say that because it is, when you first experience it, there's something profoundly isolating. And I mean, my department, because I teach in African American studies, is this recipient of all kinds of death threats constantly. We have panic buttons, all these sorts of things. But
oh my God.
Even though, you know, we're faculty that has lots of people who are subject to those kinds of attacks, it's sort of the first time that you experience it, it does feel incredibly isolating and you feel incredibly vulnerable. I do think there's a measure, even often of kind of sympathetic people, of disbelief about what it's actually like. And so it's also, I think, I mean, for me, it's very important to hear you speak out about it, because oftentimes, you know, you may run into it or witness it or kind of in passing, but not realize that an individual is just being inundated and threatened on multiple platforms. And that's the other piece too, right? It's never just Twitter or Instagram, it's also Facebook and email and phone records and all. Yeah.
It so is. It can feel like it's coming at you from every direction. And there is this, I mean, I think that whole feeling of isolation, like this is happening to me. And also just this little piece of, and it's my fault because I'm not doing this right. I think that is so characteristic of the experience of racialized or gendered abuses, you know, and it clicks right into what we know about trauma, which is like, if you don't have validation of your trauma, if you don't see it as kind of a shared experience, something that is, do you know what I mean? Something that is not your fault, but actually is like has an origin that is outside of your body, then that actually translates into worse trauma than if you, you know, than if you have a community that you're connected to and you understand these experiences are universal and that it has nothing to do with you. It really has to do with, you know, power structures outside of you. And so I think that's the part. It's like by definition, we all feel like we're going through this alone. And that's what, you know, and that's what kind of builds on fear, on reluctance to sort of stand up and speak out, because it seems like there's only the downside.
I think that's really beautifully stated, because it makes me, I guess it's connects to something else that I was interested in hearing your thoughts about, which is the intersection, but like the isolation of this moment. And, you know, so in a sense, we lived through this national collective trauma of the Trump presidency, right? And then COVID, and then we each have our personal encounters, and then we're experiencing grief alone. I mean, together, but also alone. I mean, I had this period of several weeks where I was, every week I had to call my mother and tell her that someone we knew had passed away from COVID. And so I guess, you know, I'm interested in your thoughts about that. How, and if you have thoughts about how to best, I mean, sort of navigate it on a personal level, right? And you are navigating it on multiple, like a professional level, but you're also, you know, nurses and physicians have been at risk and hospital workers. And, you know, I don't know if you have anything to help me figure it out.
I don't know. It's a really good question. And it has been such an issue because, and again, I cannot believe we're in year two of this, you know, because there's some things where I'm like, oh yeah, I remember when I had this phase of how I felt about it, you know, like a year ago now, when we were first being like, I mean, I have a text from February 11th from a friend who was like, hey, is this coronavirus thing going to be a thing? And I wrote back and I said, I think so. That's our exchange. Like just this quick two thing. I know. I was like, I think it's going to be. And we have passed that back and forth between, you know, between the two of us a couple of times being like, it was such a light conversation, you know? It's like, even when I said, I think so, there's no way I could have predicted all this.
To support this show and DubLab's progressive program, go to dublab.com/support.
This can be over quick, but it's going to be hard. So let's just put our heads down and just get through. And I was basically like, okay, I did internship for a year. You know, that was like hard stuff. I had twins. That was a really hard year. You know, I was like, there's nothing I can't do for 3 to 6 months. And so it was basically like, sleep is optional right now. We have stuff to do, you know, and it was basically like from my hospital needing to plan to like being as a researcher, being like, there's data that we need to collect right now because this will never happen again, to, you know, trying to become messengers and relay information in this coordinated way as best we can about face mask wearing and stuff like that. I mean, at the very beginning, it was like, exhaustion is here, but we are built for this, you know, and there was kind of this pride among physicians that we were not weak, you know, that we had this tolerance for sleeplessness, for stress, for crisis that we had really been trained for. I mean, literally trained for. And I think we didn't appreciate for a long time how much, yes, we're trained, but we're trained for very discrete short-term crises. You know, I mean, a bus turns over, I am ready for that. You know, there's an earthquake, I am ready for that. But it's like something that's as sustained as a pandemic that we have an inadequate response to, where there appear to be no robust resources in any direction. I mean, so many of us were, you know, with a whole like public health infrastructure that had been completely derailed. It was on this level that I think none of us were prepared for. And so I think it took me like 4 or 5 months to be like, okay, all right, you know, I'm like crying uncle here. Like, we need to take a breath, you know, and figure out how we're sustaining ourselves for the long haul. And I think, you know, I think that's where I really became like planned indulgence, you know? I mean, I have days where I'm like, today I'm making a plan for my kids, or I'm asking this of my husband, and I need to just watch TV for like 8 hours.
Yes.
Like really, really long time. Not news. Like, I'm going to watch Bridgerton, the entire thing, twice, you know? And I really actually like, I mean, I do those things so deliberately, not passively. You know, I'm not like, I happen to be sitting here. I'm really like, I need this weekend, this entire weekend, I'm not even going to read emails, you know? And so, I mean, I think that's been part of it. And then I think part of it too has been being you know, we're physically distant, but being like aggressively socially close. I mean, this has been part of like, I show up for every damn Yale thing that is planned, you know, because it's like, it's such an opportunity for connection. And I was not like a shower upper for those kind of things reliably in the past. But I think when there's a chance to connect really meaningfully with people, I mean, I text friends more than ever before, you know, it's like, I really try to just talk on the phone with people. And it's like, again, it's something that I'm not just like, ah, I feel like calling this person, but I'm like, I need to connect to people and trying to build as much of that into my life as possible. I think those are the things. And then I think also just recognizing that, you know, it was so interesting. There are a bunch of studies that were done early on, like of the docs who were in New York City at the epicenter of the pandemic. And they were asking them about anxiety and depression. And we've seen this in different forms now. And people, yes, had tons of anxiety, had tons of depression, had a lot of very specific worries about, you know, risk and things like that. But they also reported, actually, I think the highest thing that was reported out in terms of how they were feeling was a sense of higher purpose.
Yeah, I know.
And I was like, we underestimate humans when we say things like depression and anxiety are bringing down these healthcare workers. I mean, it's true. It was so there, but I was so glad they asked that question about, you know, about this thing that elevated them as well, because it's there. And, you know, when we say things like, humans now are going to be socially disconnected after the pandemic forever. It's like, I don't believe those things. Actually, I think we're actually going to come back stronger because we've really learned to appreciate it. And so hopefully, like, you know, the permanent stamp on our psyche will weather everything we're going through. It's just, you know, it's really not going to be until fall. I think I'm trying not to, while being positive about vaccine, I've been very conscious of not raising people's hopes about, you know, about getting back to normal or whatever too soon. So.
You know, it's your description reminds me of how veterans of the civil rights movement talk about, you know, who suffered through death and threat and beatings, and talk about it as a glorious time because they were doing the work of transforming the world, you know. And it's clear there's the effects of trauma, right? A lot of, I mean, I experience it with people who are veterans of the movement in my life, and yet, you know, they sustain incredible amounts of joy because they had lived a meaningful life. I have my father died some years ago, and he was an epidemiologist. And I have this memory of when he was, I mean, when I was, I don't know, maybe like 10 and he said, and he had tears in his eyes, and he said, we can control HIV. There just isn't the will to do so. He's like, we know how to do. And so I've been thinking a lot about that, of course, now, right? And, you know, wondering if we had the will to do so collectively, and if we could move, you know, the various sort of governmental actors, economic leaders, all of it, right? What would we do now to respond to this pandemic and also all of the other forms of inequality that it exposes, you know, in terms of health? I mean, obviously I'm not asking you to solve the world's problems, although I think you probably could, but what would you say?
Yeah. I mean, I think what is really obvious right now is that we can't create equity in an inequitable system. You know, I mean, it's like, I have a friend who's doing work at UVA, and you know, they were talking about, okay, we're going to distribute vaccine by emailing people, and we'll create these categories, and then we'll let people know when their time is by email. And then they realized that the custodial staff actually didn't have institutional emails, you know? So they were completely cut out of the information process, the basic information process of even which category they were in, where they could go for the vaccine, how to sign up. That whole bundle was administered through email. And it's, you know, I mean, there's also, like, I know there's so much about, you know, how we shouldn't be relying on, you know, on digital systems anyway. But aside from that, just like there, that's just, to me, was such a concrete example of the millions of ways in which we've just built up this structure that is well designed for the outcome it seems to seek, which is one of inequity, you know? And so, you know, and so there's all this hand waving right now about how do we build back trust in this moment? It's like, you don't have a chance in hell of building back trust. But, you know, it's like, please do not try to engage in that conversation. Trust is not something we can earn in this moment because we have things set up like this and we can't fix that in the moment, you know? So I think it's more like, how do we work despite our systems? And I think there has to be so much discipline about how we administer vaccines, where they go, who gets first allocation and second allocation. And I think I'm actually in the process with my group of kind of building a library of examples of small ways that people are doing it. And unfortunately, I mean, what I would like from the government is more structure and specificity around operationalizing ideals, you know, because this has been the year of ideals. You know, it's like we need to apply a health equity lens to everything. None of us believe in racism. We're all anti-racism. Okay, so show me, explain to me, because there are entire states that aren't even releasing data about vaccine distribution by race and ethnicity. So what is the commitment here to anti-racism if you can't even demonstrate any data about what your priorities are, what your execution has been about you know, equitable vaccine, just, you know, what your success rate has been? It's like, if you're not even looking at the data, you don't care. I mean, you fundamentally, whether that's on an individual basis or a structural basis, leadership basis, you don't care. There is zero commitment to equity if you're not measuring the thing that you're allegedly committed to. Do you know what I mean? And so it's just like, what I want is like data transparency and then operationalizing strategies, you know? And I think until that happens, it's so not, I mean, like my own state of Oregon has decided that teachers are the priority group, you know? So it's like, I mean, I'm an ER doc, so my approach is very literal. It's like, who has been dying? Because whoever has been dying, that's who should get the vaccine first, you know? And I think, who's exposed, who's getting disease, and who's dying? Like, those should be the groups. And if you don't fall into one of those categories, then why are you at the front of the line? But I think states that have chosen not to do that, and actually, if you just did that, if you were just like, my priority list is who's dying and who's getting disease, if you just took that approach, then it should naturally go to the elderly and people of color, right? Because that's who's getting disease and dying. And yet it's not happening. You know, I mean, we're having all these, like New Jersey was like smokers, you know, it's like, maybe? Like, what is that? Are smokers dying? I wasn't actually aware that smokers were getting disease and dying. And maybe they are, and I don't know it. I mean, I think probably what they were trying to get at was chronic lung disease, some of which, you know, puts you at increased risk of COVID. But I think, you know, it's like when people go to operationalize, they're making these kind of decisions that are completely not equity informed. And so I think what I would like is, you know, for our elected leaders, our health officials, both at the federal level, at the state level, being like, here are really the principles to reverse the inequities that we have had thus far in the pandemic. Every resource, starting with testing, you know, starting with access to healthcare, even who gets the medications, you know, it's like every single step, who has PPE? It's like every single valuable resource in this pandemic has been distributed inequitably. I mean, if you look at remdesivir, which was like that first, you know, FDA, mm-hmm. Approved drug for the treatment of COVID. We have hardly any treatment drugs, but remdesivir was one of those that had this kind of modest impact. But, you know, we were excited about it as a nation. When they distributed the limited supply of remdesivir to Boston, it went everywhere to all these small private hospitals, went all around Boston, and it skipped Boston Medical Center, you know, which is where I trained. It's in South Boston. You know, it is the safety net hospital of that area, provides most of the free care and serves the biggest Black population in Boston by far, you know, even close, because of the way that there's such housing segregation in Boston. You know, I trained at Boston Medical Center. It's my favorite institution, but it's like, they're like, where's our remdesivir? It's like, again, it was like systematically put in place that there'd be a fundamental inequity in the use of remdesivir. And then we saw it documented. I mean, studies were published about, you know, what is the racial and ethnic breakdown of who got remdesivir when they went in the hospital and were diagnosed with COVID. And there was this extremely sharp breakdown. One of the early cancer studies just among cancer patients who were being treated more aggressively showed that Black Americans were about half as likely as white Americans to be treated with remdesivir. And you're like, of course, you know? So anyway, so it's like, so then we get to vaccine. And I mean, there are so many issues and nuances, but it's like, and among them is, the entire health system has behaved in a certain way up until this point. And then all of a sudden we're going to behave differently. Like, that's weird too. Do you know what I mean? It's like, even when you try to do the right thing, you've so set up things that it's even hard to execute, because then it seems like, you know, the motivation is what, experimentation. It just feels off. But it's also hard to reverse the compounding inequities. But if we have, like, you know, our only chance in hell by doing it in a very concerted effort with everybody on board, that's what needs to happen. And so anyway, that was a really long answer to your question, but
a wonderful one. And I mean, I think, you know, what it reminds me is that is, you know, Americans are so fixated on being innocent of any wrongdoing. It's like one of the aspects of our culture, right? But that, you know, what I think you have communicated so profoundly is that, you know, okay, well, we all are participants in an unjust system, and then you accept that and then try to do something meaningful nevertheless, even knowing that there has to be some major transformation to get to the just society, that's what it means to be involved and of service. So, yeah.
Yeah. I love the way you put that. And I think there's like, we chip away in the ways that we can at big change, you know, and then in the moment we do what we do, which is develop out a whole bunch of coping strategies, you know, things that just fill in the cracks here and there until we can do that big change. I think that's what this year is about.
Well, on that note, thank you so much, Esther.
Thank you. It was just great to talk to you.
You have to do it in real life.
I would love to, actually. Let's do some... I would just love to be in conversation with you and see what we could do together.
Okay. Sounds good to me. All right. Take care.
Take care.
To support this show and DubLab's progressive programming, go to dublab.com/support.